Almost all of this work was done from a rather dull, colorless set of offices tucked away in the peaceful woods of Langley, Virginia. That wasn't at all the kind of work Mike Vickers had envisioned doing when he'd signed on with the CIA. He'd had visions then of becoming a modern T.E. Lawrence. But Vickers was, above all, a man of modern times and new technologies, and he quickly came to feel that had Lawrence spent his time with the Mujahideen, he might not have made much of a difference at all. The agency's paramilitary cowboys were always coming upstairs, urging him and Gust to let them mount special operations in Afghanistan. In his own daydream, Vickers would head off into the Panjshir Valley to advise Masoud, the Afghan he most admired. The two men were born the same year, and he would have loved nothing more than to disappear into the mountains with the lion of the Panjshir to trap and hunt and harass the common foe. But Vickers knew it was of no value for a few Americans to run operations in Afghanistan. The Mujahideen, and when needed, the Pakistan ISI, were doing that kind of work for themselves. The creative thing in this war was for the CIA to transform these men into techno-guerrillas. It required a certain kind of imagination to visualize from paper the army Vickers was sculpting. Vickers had read long and deep into the history of unconventional warfare. He knew he had a historic commission. He was designing a new prototype, and to him it was a work of military art. Vickers is one of those rare men who basically mark their own report cards, and in February 1986 he was able to peer into the future, see the creature he had been bringing to life, and pronounce it a full-blown success. Upon seeing those satellite photos of the carnage on the Gardez to Kabul highway, Vickers had felt great satisfaction. From then on, he had had little doubt that the CIA's strategy would succeed, and he told Gust this when he said he had reached his decision to leave the agency. But in all fairness, it's highly unlikely that Mike Vickers, after almost 3 years in the CIA, would have suddenly decided to leave simply because he believed that the important creative contribution he had to offer was largely complete. What happened was that Vickers had focused his analytical powers not just on the strengths and weaknesses of the Mujahideen and the Red Army, but on the way things worked in his own spy agency, and he hadn't liked what he'd discovered. By the beginning of 1986, Vickers realized he was calling the shots on 57% of the Directorate of Operations' total budget. He had by then grown accustomed to running the biggest CIA paramilitary campaign in history. But an experience the previous month had jolted him into the realization that on paper he was not running anything. 20,000 people worked at CIA. It was a bureaucracy. It had its rules and its routes to power and responsibility. And as far as the official record was concerned, he was one of the lowest case officers involved. Gust might be using him to do the equivalent work of an army field commander at war, but in the official records he was the equivalent of a captain or major. The army captains and majors don't get to do the job of a General Schwarzkopf. The previous fall, Gust and Bert Dunn had sought a promotion for Vickers. The promotion board had gone along only after Dunn had threatened to have Claire George overrule them if they refused. But the officer in charge had given Vickers the sobering news that he would have been far better off doing what ordinary junior case officers do than performing a function that could not really be recognized since he wasn't supposed to be doing it. A senior CIA official had told him earlier that it would be another 10 or 15 years, if he was lucky, before he could count on getting such responsibility again. The official told Vickers that the Afghan operation was the highlight of his own 20-year career. Vickers was now coming to recognize just what a strange aberration this Afghan operation had been. Nothing he had been able to do would have been possible without Gust, but Avrakatos's license to operate came from Bert Dunn, who was about to leave to become Claire George's assistant deputy director of operations. That should have strengthened Gust's position, but there was a catch. The front-runner to inherit Dunn's job was Tom Twetton, and if that happened, Vickers' all-important patron, Gust Avrakatos, was going to be seriously out of luck. Technically, Tom Twetton, as Near East Division Deputy Chief, had been Avrakatos' boss for over 2 years, but Gust had carved out a strange and independent role, dealing with Wilson at times, with Casey at other times, and always with a direct line to Dunn. And for his own perverse reasons, Gust had chosen simply to ignore Twetton whenever possible, and sometimes to taunt him for no good reason at all. Part of it was just a personality thing. Gust used to refer to Twetton as Mr. Rogers when talking with the Dirty Dozen, and the nickname had caught on. The one thing professional spies do well is build information networks, and Twetton was a pro who'd quickly learned his nickname. One of the ways of Rokitos and Wilson had initially developed a rapport was by telling crude jokes at Tom Twetton's expense, and for some reason Gust used to refuse to answer Twetton's calls until he had kept him waiting for at least a minute. His secretary would find it excruciating to keep Twetton on hold while Gust would read his mail until he felt he had made his point, then pick up the phone and gruffly say hello, as if he had far more important and pressing business to tend to than taking a call from Tom Twetton. All that might have mattered little had it not been for the ugly incident the month before. Oliver North had stormed out to the agency demanding access to a Swiss bank account to deposit the proceeds from one of the Iranian arms for hostages sales. He wanted it immediately, and Twetton wanted to satisfy this important White House emissary. Gust said no. This time, Avrakatos was not acting out of some adolescent need to tweak the deputy division chief. He thought the request was asinine and dangerous, and to him it was a matter of principle to resist. So far, no one had bothered the agency about its Afghan operation. No one was demanding the same kind of conformity to the rules as they were in Central America, and Gust knew the program couldn't stand examination. All they needed was to have one scandal break and the floodgates would open. The deputy division chief was asking him to mingle Iranian arms for hostages funds with the Saudi account, an account that to Gust was sacred. The Saudis were giving a fortune to the CIA with no strings attached, and that money had an added value because it didn't have to be accounted for the way congressionally appropriated monies did. Gust had bent over backward to make sure nothing jeopardized this Saudi connection. When the king had sent his son to Langley for a month, Avrakatos had made sure the young prince was treated like a prince of old. He'd even consulted the agency's great expert on Saudi Arabia and Iran, George Cave, who'd advised that because of Muslim prohibitions on usury, the agency probably should not put the money in an interest-bearing account. Gust had put the choice on the Saudis, who thanked the agency for its sensitivity to their religion and opted for the no-interest alternative. As far as Gust was concerned, Twetton was so eager to please Oliver North and the White House that he was prepared to jeopardize this Saudi connection. Avrakatos wasn't going to let him do it. Twetton called on a secure line to ask for the account number. "What for? You don't have a need to know," Avrakatos answered. "I certainly do. Call Claire." "Fuck you. Have Claire call me." Soon after that conversation, Hilly Billy, Gust's finance man, said he was being pressured to cough up the number. "Refer the calls to me," Gust said. When Twetton called back citing the orders of the National Security Council, Avrakatos ended the exchange by saying, "Have Casey order me." Gust says he also told Twetton, "You're going to go to jail." Twetton finally managed to get the head of finance to give him the account number. Even more disquieting, however, were the other things going on with Iran-Contra. For starters, Claire George had sealed off the special Iran room and denied Avrakatos access. What was known was that at least part of the Iranian account had been taken from Avrakatos. Gust's political fortunes within the Directorate of Operations were once again coming under a cloud. It didn't help Gust one little bit that John McMahon had already resigned that February. Andy Aieva and Free the Eagle tried to claim that they were responsible, and that they had saved the day for the Afghans by getting rid of their one true enemy inside the agency. But McMahon had been one of Gust's most important patrons. His had always been a voice of caution in Bill Casey's CIA. He had insisted on old-fashioned efforts to conceal the American hand, but John McMahon had also been a key friend of the program who'd ultimately backed every major escalation. Every single person in the Directorate of Operations, including Avrakatos, had stood in line to shake hands and say goodbye to the 30-year veteran. Ed Jinowitz, the ADDO, who had appointed Gust to his job when Claire George was out of town and who had continued to serve as an ally, was also stepping down. Something even seemed to be wrong with Bill Casey. There were rumors about his health and about investigations underway. Vickers had the option of staying on in his current job, certainly as long as Gust remained in charge. If that didn't appeal to him, Bert Dunn was offering to get him his choice of a foreign assignment anywhere he wanted to go if he stayed for another year. But it all seemed so incredibly small time compared to what he had become used to. A meeting with the CIA's career management staff confirmed Mike Vickers's fears. Avrakatos and Dunn might have pushed to get him promoted to GS-12 due to the nature of his work, but it would be at least 5 years before he could expect to make GS-13. According to the career management officer, Vickers would have to complete 2 overseas tours of 2 years each before he would be eligible for promotion to the next level. He thought it through again and again, and every time he projected out the likely course of a CIA career without Gust and Bert in the Afghan program, it always came out dull as dishwater. It might have been different if Vickers had felt that Gust really needed him. Had he honestly believed that there was that much to do, he might have been persuaded to stay. But by now his calculations and projections were complete. The program's next 3 years were set. Any competent officer could implement it. Even the Stinger deployment had been fully prepared. Later, Gust would have to acknowledge that his young friend was right. Because so much of the money they would need to sustain their effort was already obligated for future weapons delivery, no one would be able to change the plan that Vickers had set in motion. It didn't matter how powerful the chief of station in Islamabad might be or how differently he or someone at headquarters might want to do things. They had to go along with the weapons and ammunition deliveries, or else give back the money to the Treasury. That was the nature of obligated money. It didn't have to be spent that year, but once obligated, the contracts were set in cement. Almost anyone could now run Vickers's program because his hand would be at the helm for the next 3 years, guiding each new shipment of goods to the front.